Now, we just, those of you who were in the first hour, just heard a powerful sermon by Jamie on Galatians 6:14. Let me read it. Far be it from me to boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. And I am sitting here thinking, in the next hour, I have to talk about material things and economic development. But Jamie's message was so good and so strong on we've been crucified to the world and the world's been crucified to us. And I think that means that we start out as Christians saying we're dead to the pull and attraction of material wealth. And Christ has to be first in our affection, and we have to understand that he's sufficient for us, and not to set our hearts on these things. And honestly, I'll tell you what I was thinking about during the sermon. I was thinking about my car. See, the first 11 years we lived here in Arizona, I had a car I liked. It was a Chrysler Sebring, but it was getting really old, and last year it was 13 years old, and it kind of worked. And I didn't have any trouble not loving it. But it kept getting more and more costly to repair. And certain, you know, stuff didn't work. The power locks didn't work. The windows were kind of going slow and the different things. So finally, but then there were more expensive repairs. So you get to that point where you say you're going to get a different car. So with Eric Nielsen's good help, I got a new car. First time I've ever bought a new car for myself in my life. And it's a Volkswagen EOS, E-O-S it's called. And I like it a lot. I was just thinking this morning driving here, when I step on the gas, it goes forward. I do like this car. But that sermon was saying, Wayne, you can't love the car. You've got to love Jesus. And so this is a good reminder. I don't know, somebody over in this section, somebody, Craig or somebody last week, brought this kind of up right at the end of the question and answer session. Isn't this a danger that we'll focus too much on material possessions and wealth? And it really is. So I just want to say that at the beginning, while we want people to progress materially, while we want nations to go from, can we get the next slide? Do page down or something? There we go. Well, we want nations to go from dark red, very poor, to red, poor, to blue, middle income, to green, more wealthy. We want that to happen, but we have to keep in mind continually as Christians that it's a very secondary thing, and it's not where our hearts can be. And can you stay with me on that? Do you hear the need for focusing on that? And so, first of all, it has to be relationship with Christ. And the other verse that came to mind when I was sitting there in the sermon is this: do not love the world. 1 John 2:15. Do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. So the world is passing away with its desires. Whoever does the will of God abides forever. And verse 16 is in there too. I didn't read that, but it's all really good. So, okay, just to remind myself, I'm so excited about the fact that a free market system and rule of law and property rights and restrictions on government and protecting people's freedoms and good cultural values, those all lead to economic development. But I can't be so excited about that it just becomes so large in my mind that I lose track of the fact that our hearts have to be set on Christ and not on these things. Are you okay with this? So that sermon was a really wonderful reminder. Okay, so now, having said that, still, if we're talking about how to solve poverty in poor nations, we're going to have to talk about economics and material things, and economic growth. So we have to talk about those things. So here we go again, remembering that this whole lesson is secondary. It's not primary. Just got to keep that in mind, because it's so easy to get so excited about, oh, your GDP can grow. Your per capita income can grow. Isn't this wonderful? Well, okay, but it's secondary. Okay, so now, the moral advantages of the system. Is a free market system what some people call a capitalist system, though we haven't used the word capitalism because it's too often misunderstood? Is a free market system immoral because it depends on greed and selfishness and it leads to too much inequality? Before I start giving the moral advantages of the system, and Barry Asmus and I thought, we really need to talk about the moral advantages of the system, but we want to make some qualifications. And this, again, Barry, all these ideas, is Barry here this morning? I don't know. He sometimes is able to come. These are his ideas that I have kind of reformulated into an outline, but he gets most of the credit for this section of the book. But here are the comments. We're going to say number one. Free markets do not make morally perfect people. Romans 3:23 still applies even if you have a free market economy. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Even in a free market, that's still true. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And there is still sin in people's lives. Therefore, number two, every economic system has sinful people in it. People who do morally wrong things. Number three, free markets are not the cure for every conceivable human defect. So you can have free markets and a productive economy, and people can be still selfish and rude and impolite and discourteous. And people tell these stories, what about this company who, you know, they cut corners and they made a product that endangered people, and then people got hurt and some people died. Isn't that the fault of your free market system? No, it's the fault of the evil people who are in every system. The real question is this. Does a free market system tend to discourage and punish wrong behavior and tend to encourage and reward virtuous behavior better than other systems? And to that, our answer is resoundingly yes. And people that make dangerous products that harm people in a free market system are held accountable for those products. Then I added this number five was not in the outline, it's not in the book. But I added it, and this is, I think, a general truth. The more government controls our time, money, and actions, the more we lose these moral advantages about discouraging wrong behavior, encouraging virtuous behavior. And the other moral advantages, there are 16 of them that I want to mention now as we work through this outline today. But when a government grows and grows and grows, people's moral advantages that you see in a free market system diminish. So let's go now. Overview of the outline first. Point A, the free market promotes personal freedom, and I want to talk about two items under that. Point B, it promotes personal virtues, not just freedom, but virtues, good moral qualities. Point C is going to be it promotes interpersonal values, not just personal moral qualities in the individual, but also how people relate to one another. And then point D, it promotes societal values. It helps make the kind of society that we find to be desirable. And then those four areas, and then we'll go to answer some objections at the end. So let's go back to point A on page one. Free market moral advantages, number one, promoting personal freedom. And if I am on a radio interview and I just have a minute or two to say what are the moral advantages of a free market system, here's what I say in one sentence. I say, if the government takes away all your money and spends it for you, you have no moral value in this way you spend your money because you didn't choose it. But if you are left free to decide how to choose your money, then you make morally significant decisions. You can decide to be selfish or generous. You can decide to be responsible or irresponsible with your money. When you have freedom to decide how to use your money, then you have moral responsibility and moral accountability, and you can do morally good things. I did some statistics last night with some global indexes of philanthropic giving. And you know, Sweden gives 1% of its total national income. 1% of its total national income goes to aid for poor countries, 1%. And people say, look at the United States. I know it gives a lot more by numerical value, but it's only 0.2% that the U.S. government gives in foreign aid. See how the Swedish government is much more generous. It gives 1%, and the United States government just gives 0.2%, just a 1/5 of what Sweden gives. But my answer is, well, wait a minute. That's the government deciding to give away other people's money. Where's the moral value in that for the ordinary Swedish citizen? They didn't decide voluntarily to give their money. It was taxed from them, and then the government gave it away. Oh, wait a minute. What if we look at personal charitable giving to overseas causes? How do the countries compare? When you compare personal charitable giving from the United States to poor nations, it is 6 times greater than Sweden. That is, the average person in the United States gives 6 times more charitable giving to overseas poor nations than the average person in Sweden. 6 times. And 5 times more than the average person in Norway. Well, that's because it's our money and we're free to do with it what we want. In Sweden and Norway, it's such a heavily taxed system that the government takes it away. You don't have as much left to spend and much to decide to spend. And so do you see the moral advantage of a free market system where you have the free choice to decide what you're going to do? So, number one, promoting freedom of choice for moral actions. A free market gives more freedom and responsibility to individuals to make economic decisions. This allows us to make morally significant decisions. If governments take all your money and decide how to spend it, you lose moral significance for your economic actions. You can no longer act as a responsible steward before God for your possessions. And that's the general principle that Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 4. He mentions it with regard to his apostolic ministry. But I think it's a general principle about stewardship. When God entrusts something to you, you are responsible for how you use it. God has entrusted talents to you, time to you, skills to you, money to you. Then how are you using it? 1 Corinthians 4:2, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. It is required of stewards that they become found faithful. An economic system should not control but influence people's economic decisions by persuasion and not force. Point B, free markets thrive on the non-aggression principle, which protects human freedom. Force is inadmissible between persons. So the free market depends on people making voluntary exchanges. And this is a very strong moral value in the Bible, to make voluntary choices of your own free will. Now, I don't mean to contradict my high view of God's sovereignty when I say free will. I mean free will. I mean decisions which we willingly decide to make and for which God holds us accountable. Starts back in Genesis 2:17, of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the midst of the garden, you shall not eat. That's letting Adam and Eve have a choice. Choose you this day whom you will serve. Joshua 24. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Revelation 22:17. The Spirit and the bride say, come, and let him who hears say, come, and let the thirsty come and drink the water of life without price. There's an appeal to our will to choose to follow Christ and be obedient to God. In the Old Testament, point three, slavery and oppression are viewed negatively because people didn't have that freedom of choice. They were slaves. The Old Testament, however, promises a deliverer, a Messiah, who would come to proclaim liberty to the captives, Isaiah 61:1. So human freedom and human choice are essential components of our humanity. They're a clear reflection of creation in the image of God. Freedom of choice, therefore, is a big deal in the Bible. It's highly important. And a free market where you have stewardship over your possessions gives you more freedom of choice and more moral responsibility. Point C, freedom of choice is important for building other virtues in a nation: punctuality, courtesy, trust, responsibility. That is, when you have freedom to decide how you use your time or how you act toward others, then those virtues can be more strongly developed. Number two, promoting freedom, this is another second moral advantage of the free market system. Promoting freedom to pursue abstract or spiritual pursuits. If you are in a socialist or a communist economy and you want to write music, good luck. Or you just want to stay home and paint paintings all day and hope you could make it as an artist. Good luck. No, the government assigns you a job, and you have to spend your time going to that factory or working at that farm or working at that job. And you don't have the choice to pursue abstract or spiritual pursuits because that isn't valuable to the government. And that is especially important for Christian ministries. If you want to pursue Christian ministry, if you want to go to Phoenix Seminary and take your savings out of your bank account and pay for seminary training and then hope that you'll have a career in the church in the future, you're free to do that in a free market economy. But in a socialist economy, you have an assigned job, and much less likely you could have freedom to pursue Christian ministry as a career or as a part-time vocation or to give funding to these things from money that you have. So I'm going to skip over some of the points in the outline. Study of Mark Zupan in a decentralized private property order. The individual rights are secure, and it protects people's freedom. Father Sirico, the head of the Acton Institute, in a book called Defending the Free Market, says, wait a minute, don't just think when you interact with the material creation, that just is materialism, because when you as a human being interact with the material creation, you are showing your spiritual nature and your creativity in the image of God. When you create a tasty meal, it isn't just making food to keep yourself alive, it is also creativity and inventiveness and instinct of what is tasting good and what isn't. And there's, in all our interaction with the material world, we manifest something of our creaturely creativeness that God gave us. So, and I put point C here, number 2C. No significant evangelical seminaries, to my knowledge, no publishing houses that are of significance in the world, no academic publications that have influenced the evangelical academic world have ever come from socialist or communist countries or totalitarian countries generally, so far as I know, and no evangelism of other countries. Take Russia under communism, take Cuba under communism, take North Korea. Now, China has some free market reforms, but it's mixed. But there aren't any seminaries in there training scholars that are writing commentaries that other people are reading. There aren't publishing houses in those countries putting out publications that are known throughout the world. Now, some in China to some extent because there's some freedom for internal consumption. But what are they publishing? They're publishing works written in England or the United States primarily. So freedom to go study at Tyndale House in England, for instance, where Peter Williams comes from, we know that's mostly free countries. You don't get very many people at all. Very seldom would you get someone from a Cuba. Occasionally people get out of Cuba, but not very much. And no, those countries do not send out missionaries to other countries because they can't do it, because the government doesn't allow them to do it. But a free market system, the more free the market system is, the more the church is able to proliferate and grow and influence other countries. Is that making sense? So far, you with me? Moral advantage of a free market system: freedom for morally significant choices with our resources, freedom to pursue abstract or spiritual pursuits. Number three, now we've got to get to personal virtues. Freedom to promote personal integrity and truth-telling. When future voluntary exchanges are expected, individuals are more willing to do the right thing today. This repeated voluntary exchanges reinforces truthfulness. If the grocer lies to you about the freshness of the milk or the freshness of the bread, are you going to go back to that grocer? No. So it's to the grocer's business advantage to tell the truth. And so it is with other places you shop. When vendors tell the truth about their product, you want to do business with them over a longer period of time. And some of you who have actually been in the business world, in manufacturing or in real estate, stuff, if you find that somebody's lied to you about a part of a transaction, you won't go back to that person. And so the society, by the fact that you have other grocers you can go to, or other mechanics you can get your car repaired at besides the one that lied to you. I did have that happen to me here in Scottsdale a few years ago, where I went to a dealer, they said they replaced a part, and they didn't replace it. No, I've never gone back to them. So a free market system where people have choices promotes truth-telling. And interestingly enough, this Index of Economic Freedom from the Heritage Foundation, it ranks freedom from corruption in 179 countries. Look who's at the lower end of the scale. There are unfree, government-controlled economies. Way down at the bottom of the scale are people that are also at the bottom of the scale on freedom from corruption. Myanmar, it scores 14 out of 100 possible points on freedom from corruption. You don't want to do business there. Uzbekistan, 16 out of 100. Venezuela, where the Pope comes from, 20 out of 100. Russia, 21. Democratic Republic of the Congo, 20. Zimbabwe, 24. You don't want to go invest in those countries. You don't want to do business in those countries because freedom from corruption is very low. People lie to you. They don't tell the truth. They don't keep their word. Compared to Denmark, these free nations, freedom from corruption, 93, New Zealand, 93, Singapore, 93, Canada, 89, Netherlands, 89, on freedom from corruption. These are free market economies. It seems to me there's a connection. Greater freedom in the economy provides an incentive to truth-telling. Number four, promoting accountability. The only voluntary exchanges people desire in a free market system are positive sum ones in which they benefit. This motivates sellers to work hard to make customers happy, not just fill a government quota and stamp the card and go home. So Margaret and I had some window repairs done recently at our house. And really nice guy was in charge of it and his helper, and they came and they did all the window repairs and they left. And after they left, the next day I looked and the caulking wasn't right at the bottom of one of these windows. So I called the office of the window company and I said, you know, there's one window that the caulking didn't come out quite right. It's bubbled and it doesn't look good. What do you think they did? Marilyn? They sent the same guy back out to fix it. We're sorry, we will make it right. Why? He's accountable for his actions. Because I have a choice of other window repair people, and so do my neighbors that I talk to about whether this company did a good job on window repair or not. And so it's to their advantage to have accountability for their employees. A free market system does that. If you're in a controlled economy where there's only one window repair company in your town or your community, they don't care. So the absence of free markets and property rights often encourages lying, thievery, and bribery of officials because the government is handing out the favors rather than the free choices of individuals. So there's more effort expended in redistributing wealth from government treasuries than on producing wealth by doing a good job. Number five, promoting earned success. We've talked about this previously in the class. Recent research by Arthur Brooks confirms what people with common sense already knew. The primary economic factor in making people happy is not money, but earned success. I talked in the class before about a former teaching assistant of mine at Phoenix Seminary who in his younger days had been in trouble with the law, had been actually in jail for a while, but he got out and there was a significant commitment to Christ in his life. He got a job at Wendy's, and one day, he was really discouraged and wondering if anything would ever happen to his life. And one day, the manager said to him, "You're doing a good job keeping the French fries hot." And he thought, "Oh, well, I'm going to keep on doing this then, because maybe I'll get to be a shift manager. Maybe if I really work hard, I could even be a manager of a Wendy's." Well, turns out he got his life turned around. He went to ASU. He got straight A's. He came to Phoenix Seminary. He got straight A's, was my teaching assistant. Now he's in an elite law school, and he's a Blackstone Fellow with ADF because he had earned success in keeping the French fries hot. Having a responsibility and doing well at it, and a free market does that because you are rewarded or rewards are withheld according to whether you are successful in the responsibility that you are given. And that's In the Bible, that's a moral issue which wants people to be responsible to work and be productive. God put Adam and Eve in the garden to work it and to keep it, the Garden of Eden. He wanted them to have a responsibility and then fulfill that responsibility. And that's a big part of joy in one's work, which Daryl has often talked about in Ecclesiastes 2, 24 to 25 and other verses about rejoicing in your work that God gives you to do. And Paul was emphasizing this in his teaching to the Thessalonians. If anyone will not work, he will not eat. He wanted them to support themselves, be productive, and be dependent on no one. So the Bible views productive work as morally good, and the free market system does that. The free market system has something else going on. If you think back, like when you were in junior high or high school, what you wanted to do as a career, well, I can go back to junior high. I know what I want, or elementary school, and before that. What I really wanted to be was a fireman. Because I was a little boy, and boys look up to firemen. But I wouldn't have been any good at a fire. And so you get different ideas through your life. And in fact, you go and try things, and you try stuff, and you don't do a good job at it. You try something else, and you do a good job at it. The free market gives you opportunity to try different things until you find something you can do well and you enjoy, and then you have a sense of earned success. So it promotes productive work that we can do as unto the Lord. And most people eventually end up in a job they do well. The United States ranks very high among other nations in terms of people being satisfied with the job they're in and liking the job and enjoying it. Free market encourages good works and promotes satisfaction in a job well done. Now that's a moral plus. That's a moral advantage, something pleasing to God. Okay, number six. Another moral advantage of the free market in promoting personal virtues is it moderates selfishness and greed and uses them, helps people use them for good. I'm going to skip a little bit of the outline, but to point B here, a free market does not eliminate selfishness, but it can channel it into work and investment activities that actually bring good to other people. So if you get selfish people, they just want to serve themselves and earn more. Some people figure out that the way to do that is to make a product that's useful for others or do a good job at repairing windows or fixing cars or baking bread and having a bakery or something. And so their selfishness is channeled into a morally productive activity. But there are other people, for some reason, they just don't have a lot of desire to earn money. They just want to make something that's useful for other people, and the free market actually rewards them too because it frees up more of their time and enables them to go on inventing and creating. What I mean by that is people who make these apps for an iPhone that you can buy for 99 cents, I think a lot of those developers of those apps aren't saying, I want to earn money. I think some of them just love creating things. And so they say, well, I'll just put this out there and see if it's useful. I think I made something good. And then all of a sudden, thousands of people are paying them 99 cents, 99 cents, 99 cents, and they're making money. So what do? Well, they sit at home and try to make new useful things. And so whether if it's a selfish motive or just a general motive to earn a living, or even people who aren't too motivated to earn a living, a free market provides encouragement to them to produce for the benefit of others. Number seven, promoting wise use of the environment. When there's a combination of private ownership, so people take care of the resources they own, and public ownership of some state parks and resources, it does preserve use of resources. And we've got more on that in another chapter, but the countries that are most harmful to the environment, where carelessness results in destroying the purity of lakes and a lot of really reckless building of nuclear reactors like Chernobyl that had this huge meltdown in the former Soviet Union, and there are other reactors like Chernobyl still operating, very poorly built. Those things happen much more often, or high levels of lead poisoning in countries and children in Eastern Europe under socialism, so that reckless use of the environment is more common under socialism than under a free market economy. Number eight, curbing materialism and promoting personal charity. Charitable giving is far larger in free than in socialist economies or welfare states. And I don't have the statistics on charitable giving for causes within the nation, as I did for giving overseas to poor nations. But I think that, I've seen these statistics. Americans don't give as much as they should. They don't give anywhere near a tithe. If they gave tithes, even if church members gave tithes, look at how much more money there would be available. But the fact of the matter is, Americans still, and many of them don't even go to church, but Americans still give much, much more to charitable causes than many, many other countries, especially than socialist countries. And I need to get more data on that, but I've read that and haven't written it down. But I'll see if sometime I'll have that on my agenda to find out. But the reason that people can do that is in a free market economy, they are free. They have the freedom to do that because they have much more of their income free to use and dispose of. And it's not just income. It's free time, too. If you've earned enough money to support yourself and you have some time left over, then you have free time to give to the needs of others as well. There's a deeper objection to socialism, and that is socialism has a very detrimental moral influence on people. And it is amazing how Margaret Thatcher, when she was prime minister in Great Britain, in the UK, Margaret Thatcher kept coming back to that theme again and again of the moral weakness and harm that comes from socialism. And so a recent biography of Margaret Thatcher by Claire Berlinski says this: Margaret Thatcher spoke again and again and said, in all its incarnations, socialism was morally corrupting. Thatcher kept saying that socialism turned good citizens into bad ones. It turned strong nations into weak ones. It promoted vice and discouraged virtue. It transformed formerly hardworking and self-reliant men and women into whining, weak, and flabby loafers. Socialism was not a fine idea that had been misapplied. It was an inherently wicked idea. This was Thatcher's single contribution to the debate. It was a point she emphasized again and again. In the end, the real case against socialism, and these are Thatcher's words, is not its economic inefficiency, though there is evidence of that. Much more fundamental is its basic immorality. So a free market is the only path that men and women of virtue, not greed but virtue, should take. So socialism has a detrimental moral influence because it takes away that opportunity for personal stewardship and the joy of being able to make good choices with our resources. Okay, so a free market system, first of all, it provides freedom for morally significant choices. And then freedom for abstract or spiritual pursuits. Those were the first two. Second, it promotes these personal virtues of truthfulness, accountability, earned success, and moderating selfishness and greed and motivating people to do morally positive things. Okay, now, what about the way we relate to others? Point C, a free market economy helps or most strongly gives incentives to meeting the needs of others. So we say in the book that a competitive free market was the first social system in human history to direct man's desire towards peacefully supplying greater quantities of goods and services for his fellow human beings. You're not just trying to get along and get by and just have enough food to get through the next day. You're trying to provide something that's useful for other people and meets the needs of others, and you're trying to do it better and higher quality and cheaper. Number 10, it encourages you to prioritize the wants of others. By its very nature, competition prompts a company to improve everything it can to satisfy a customer. Free market competition at its heart is not about destroying the competitor, but about better satisfying customers. So Can you give me or think of some examples where a free market has motivated a company to make a better product and better meet people's, satisfies people's wants for a good product? What products are continually improving? Cars, yeah, cars. Remember back 30 years ago? If you've been driving for 30 years. The cars weren't as good as they are today. What else somebody said? Smartphones, yeah. We keep getting better because government isn't forcing a company to innovate and make a better phone. They just want to serve the needs, the wants of others and then do better than the other company. And that's true. Any other products? What? Harriet, household appliances, like a refrigerator, ovens, yeah, a lot of. So companies are continually trying to meet people's wants. So you can look around and there are all sorts of better things, and it's a free market that rewards companies that better meet the wants of other people. Number 11, treating others humanely. Historically, it's when free markets came in that there were large movements to abolish slavery, child labor, racism, sexism, violence. We've got quotations on this. As free markets have spread simultaneously or in sequence to that, many of these inhumane practices were outlawed. Number 12, truly helping the poor, because free market countries are the economically most productive. They bring the most long-term help to the poor. You people who believe in free markets, someone will say, you don't really care for the poor. Well, we do, because this is the system that increases productivity and therefore really gives opportunities to the poor. And there was a chart here that I put up from, it's taken out of our book. This is what happened to people in the United States from 1975 to 1991, 16-year period. It divided people up into the lowest, it's called quintiles, one-fifth of the population. You take the lowest one-fifth of the population, and then the next one-fifth, and the next one-fifth, and the fourth, and the fifth. The fifth is the richest people in terms of income. And the lowest quintile is the poorest people in terms of income. This is the bottom 20% of the population. What happened to them in these 16 years, 75 to 91? After 16 years, 2% of the poorest people in the country were still in the poorest category, 2%. 98% had climbed up to second, third, fourth, or fifth to higher quintile. 98%! Isn't that amazing? That people in the poorest category, lowest income, they don't stay poor. 98% of them got into a higher category. And in the second quintile, the next 20%, 78% went up to a higher category. But the richest fifth quintile, 69% of them were down in a lower category 16 years later. So the rich didn't stay rich, and the poor didn't stay poor, but there was income mobility. Give me an example of someone who was in the bottom 20% of income and then went to a higher income 16 years later. It could have been Bill Gates, who could have been. He just was trying to invent a computer program. Okay. Steve Jobs, yeah. But just ordinary people. You think about a college student who doesn't have any income because the student is going to college and then all of a sudden gets out and gets a job. Or a medical school student who's... we have a friend who went to medical school and she was just taking out loans and loans and loans, and now she's making a huge amount of money because she's suddenly working as a doctor. So she went from the lowest quintile, having basically no income, up to a much higher income. Another example would be somebody starting a business who 2 or 3 years lives off savings and doesn't get any income from the business because he's trying to build the business. And then all of a sudden, he starts getting income from the business and he moves to higher. But another situation would be just someone who starts at Walmart or at McDonald's and an entry-level job and continues to advance, and 16 years later is making a middle income. That's the ordinary path that people take in the United States over those number of years. So when people say, there's too much inequality in the United States, well, wait a minute, If there's opportunity to change, then people change. If there's opportunity to advance in their economic situation, then they do. So number 12, the moral advantage is truly helping the poor. I've got some of those statistics in the note. In a productive, growing economy, jobs are available and many poor people are able to begin to support themselves. That's what's supposed to happen. Now, I know there are problems in our society right now with high levels still of unemployment, mainly because of government messing things up, but that's another story. Number 13, a free market economy best promotes the lesser virtues. That's Lawrence Harrison's phrase. He's a Tufts University professor. Best promotes lesser virtues, punctuality, courtesy, tidiness, and a job well done. These reflect the golden rule, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do the same to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So, let me give you an example of these lesser virtues. Let's say that I'm a plumber, and I come to Cheryl's house to repair some leaking sink or something. Do I want to show up on time? Yes, because I want her to like the plumbing job that I do and recommend me to her neighbors or invite me back. So that promotes punctuality. Courtesy, do I want to be rude? And no, I don't. When people come to your home or you're taking your car for repair, generally people try to be courteous to you, and if they don't, the boss is probably going to give them another job where they're not talking to people. Promotes courtesy because you want repeated business. Tidiness, am I going to leave your sink tidy? Yes, and not make a mess all over your floor if I do clean it up because I want to be asked back. And a job well done, I'll try to do a good job because, again, this nature of repeated exchanges and business in a free market economy where you have a chance to choose other plumbers if you don't like this one. So progress-prone cultures place a higher value on these lesser virtues. And voluntary exchanges, such as hiring a plumber or a car repair salesman or person, mechanic, they encourage higher standards and reciprocal relationships. Point D, so we had freedom for moral actions, freedom of choice. We had promoting personal virtues, now interpersonal virtues. Those were 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Now we've got three more, and these are societal values. A free market best promotes a peaceful and harmonious society. And Barry found this quotation from Dinesh D'Souza, who actually was born in India and lived in New York City. Dinesh D'Souza says this: we see the evidence, and he's talking about the benefits of a free market society. We see the evidence in New York, which presents an amazing sight to the world. Tribal and religious battles, such as we see in Lebanon, Mogadishu, Kashmir, and Belfast, don't happen here. In New York restaurants, white and African American secretaries have lunch together. In Silicon Valley, now he's shifting out to California, Silicon Alley, I guess that's an area of New York City that I'm not familiar with the title. In Silicon Alley, Americans of Jewish and Palestinian descent collaborate on e-commerce solutions and play racquetball after work. Hindus and Muslims, Serbs and Croats, Turks and Armenians, Irish Catholics and British Protestants all seem to have forgotten their ancestral differences and joined in the vast and varied parade of New Yorkers. Isn't that something? A free market society where it's to people's advantage to get along with each other because they're working at the next desk in the same job. Yes, that's an advantage. Now, P.J. Hill at Wheaton, to skip down to 14D, emeritus professor from Wheaton, he contrasts the differences between market solutions and political solutions by comparing heated arguments of creationism versus evolution, political solution, against meat-eating versus vegetarianism, a market solution. And P.J. Hill says, wow, if you want to see people mad at each other and upset with each other, go to visit a local school board meeting when they're trying to discuss whether to teach creation as a theory alongside evolution. The discussion can get heated and people get upset with each other and they're yelling because the government is deciding and it makes one decision that it fits everybody. Contrast that to the decision to be vegetarian or a meat eater, carnivorous. Diet is not determined by collective decision-making process. The point is, leave it in the private sector market and people will interact peacefully about it. In fact, vegetarians and meat eaters can shop at the same stores, pushing their carts past each other with no conflict. Because it's not a political decision. People are left to their free choice. And so there's a social harmony that results from market order. Both P.J. Hill and Dinesh D'Souza are emphasizing that. And even among children, this is true. Again, Barry dug up this interesting story in the Sesame Street Parents Guide, where Catherine Hussman Klemp had 8 children. And she used to get a toy at a flea market or a garage sale and bring it home and, here kids, here's a new toy to play with. And they were constantly fighting over it. She got 3 or 4 toys, they're still fighting over them. She decided to change her process. She decided that she would never bring anything into the whole house without assigning a clear ownership to one child. This belongs to Becky, this belongs to Jamie, this belongs to Peter, this belongs to Sally. The owner would have ultimate authority over the use of the property. Second, the owner would not be required to share. Now, property rights settled the arguments. Instead of teaching selfishness, the introduction of property rights actually promoted sharing. The children were secure in their ownership, and they knew they would always get their toys back. And sharing, they found out, raises their self-esteem to see themselves as generous persons. Not only do her children value their own property rights, but they also respect the property of others. Rarely do our children use each other's themes without asking first, and they respect a no when they get one. Best of all, when someone who has every right to say no to a request says yes, the borrower sees the gift for what it is and says thanks more often than not. Isn't that interesting? So it promotes a peaceful and harmonious society. Promoting a fair society. Now, last Thursday, I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, and Dennis Rainey and Bob Lapine have this nationwide radio broadcast called Family Life Today, and they recorded two broadcasts with me on this book. But the challenge is, this is a book on economics, and their audience is mostly about how to teach children. Oh my goodness, this was a challenge, and so we talked about it a little bit. But I said, look, just as parents teach their children about sexuality in contrast to the world, they teach their children about science and creation in distinction from the world, so I think parents should be able to teach their children about economics in distinction from the world's view. And here is how it can happen. I'm going to get ahead of myself on my outline, but I'm on a roll here, so I'm just going to say. It struck me that one way to teach, and I thought of this after the radio broadcast, but anyway, I'm going to say it to you. First time I've said this publicly. I was thinking the other day, how in the world is it that I can drive year after year after year in Phoenix and Scottsdale, and nobody crosses over that median line and plows head-on into my car? These are all some sort of really stupid people driving, and they're irresponsible people driving, but they keep in their lane. Why is that? It's because the system holds them accountable if they do wrong. If you cause an accident, it's going to be a very expensive mistake. And so by and large, tens of thousands of people pass each other on these two-lane streets or four-lane streets day after day after day, and they have a very strong personal advantage in staying in their lane because the system holds them accountable. So I thought driving would be an opportunity for parents to say to their kids, why don't other people drive into us? Because they will pay a penalty if they do, a big penalty. And so it isn't because they like us. It isn't because they're good-hearted and they're watching out for our welfare. It's because the system holds them accountable for their actions. Doesn't that explain why people drive safely? I think it's a new idea with me just this last week. But I think it does. I think it answers the mystery, because these people don't care about my welfare at all. They've never met me. But they drive safely and try not to hit me. I see some, you're kind of thinking, maybe that's true, I'm not sure. Okay, promotes a fair society. Under a private property regime, this is maybe more applicable. A person who injures another or damages another's property is responsible for the damages, and courts enforce their responsibility. When people are accountable for their actions, individual freedom can be allowed. This is why it's safe to drive. Accountability with the protection of private property is consistent with what's in the Bible, because in the Exodus 22, people who damaged the property of others had to repay their neighbor. And if you lit a fire and it burned your neighbor's grain, then you had to pay back. You were accountable, and there was a penalty because you were careless. And it reflects an awareness of each person's equal value before God. So you might be saying in this driving example, well, you know, socialist or communist countries could hold people accountable too. I guess so. I guess they could. So they don't? They're reckless?
We had a taxi ride in Shanghai.
Taxi ride in Shanghai?
Shopping mall.
Yeah.
Wrong way down a one-way street.
Wrong way down a one-way street.
Quite high speed.
High speed.
We were looking to, okay, how are we going to survive when you run into something?
Okay. But what's the why aren't they as careful in Shanghai? Maybe because the government's going to take care of them whether they have an accident or not.
They don't have well-organized procedures or processes yet.
I see. Okay. Okay. So it isn't as developed a system of accountability. But surely it's why people don't damage your property. They don't bump into your car in a parking lot because it's yours and they will be accountable for it. Okay. Unless you're not in the car and they can get away. But they don't know if they can get away. Never mind. Okay. Number 16, so 15 is it promotes a fair society. That's the point where people are accountable for damaging others' property. Number 16, it promotes a productive society because productive free market economies have more resources to help the poor and more resources for the benefit of everyone in those societies. And just to finish that up, I'll go to the next slide. I had this slide earlier, but taking different regions of the world, Europe, Asia, Middle East, Americas, and Sub-Saharan Africa, in every region of the world that you look at, the five most free countries have much higher, dark blue bar here, much higher economic production than the five least free societies. In Europe, 46,000 to 13,000. In Asia, 41,000 to 3,000. Most free societies produce much, much more than the least free societies. Middle East, most free societies, 39,000. Least free societies, 7,900. In America, 25 to 8. And in Sub-Saharan Africa, 9,000 to 1,000. The wealthier societies produce more, and therefore they're more productive, and they have more resources for the benefit of everybody. And that's a moral advantage, to be able to produce more for everybody's benefit. So free markets produce productivity. Okay, now I'm going to go to the last page, point E, number 2. Objection, free markets depend on greed. Answer, no, I do not think they do. It's necessary to distinguish between greed and ordinary self-interest. Free markets depend on self-interest, but this is a morally good thing. It's part of our creation in the image of God. It's why you work, because you're interested in eating. That is, you have a self-interest to feed yourself. It's why you sleep, eat, breathe, why you wash your hands, you buckle your seatbelt, you pray for forgiveness because of self-interest. That's a morally good thing. And Adam Smith saw that as an economically beneficial thing. He said this sentence, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard for their own interest." That's a good thing. And in a free market system, self-interest motivates economic production. Greed, point C, is excessive self-interest. It's wanting more than you deserve or failing to care for the needs of others as well as yourself. You can't prevent that by laws, but no economic system has eliminated greed from everybody. But the free market system is the most likely to minimize greed's effects through the reaction of the customers. If you sense that somebody you're doing business with is greedy, then you'll tend to go and do business with somebody else. So it moderates greed And if people become greedy so they break the law, then it will punish them. But self-interest is what it depends on, and so not greed. Okay, I'm going to stop there. We've got about 7 minutes left for interaction. The rest of the outline with these objections you can look at if you wish, but those were the main points. So 16 moral advantages to a free market system over a government-controlled or planned economy, and everywhere in between, of course, there's a variety of degrees of government control, but honestly, I'm concerned about the increasing government control and government control of what we do with our resources at higher taxes takes away freedom, and it loses those moral advantages by little increments in our society even today. So there's application too. Okay, comments or questions or objections. What's your name?
My name's Gary Scott.
Gary.
Can you just talk a little bit about the new health care law in terms of there's been ideas from the conservative side on, you know, health savings accounts, personal responsibility,
right,
how that might play into it if they ever got to that?
Yeah. Well, I can say something on the safety issue. If you shop at Safeway, and all of a sudden you get repeated stories that Safeway is not treating credit card information correctly and it doesn't have adequate security, are you going to go back to Safeway? No, because you've got other choices. You can go to Bash's or Fry's or Kroger's or whatever. Okay. But if the government doesn't, if the government's the only place that you can get health insurance and they're not treating your personal data safely and it gets stolen by ID thieves and things, where are you going to go? There is no other place to go. So if all of a sudden the Arizona Motor Vehicle Department is losing driver's information to security thieves, now there'll be political accountability. I realize that there'll be a massive outcry, but that's a very long and awkward process. But the free market provides more accountability for actions, I think, is the bottom line. The other thing is, it seems to me, it's Gary? Gary, yeah. I will say one more thing about the healthcare law. Instead of maximizing personal choice and personal accountability, there are only four plans you can buy now. So that's government restricting the free market and restricting our freedom of choice. It's not quite socialized medicine, but it's going in the direction of the government controls what you can buy and what you can sell, and there will be distortions of the market as a result. Yeah, that's troublesome. I'm worried about it, or concerned, yeah. Okay, Mary Kay, I can remember Mary Kay, and...
Jean.
Jean, yes.
Did you hear the Pope's speech this week?
Yeah, I heard it a couple weeks ago, and I were you here last week,
Jean? Yes.
And I did say last week I had some problems with the Pope's speech because he talked about inequality, and I think he wasn't taking into account this.
Right, correct.
That people do grow out of... now, he's from Venezuela, and I don't think that happens in Venezuela because it's a very... Or Argentina, I'm sorry. Venezuela is even worse. He's from Argentina... Thank you, Carol. He's from Argentina, and Argentina is... It's way down at the bottom of the nations of the world in economic freedom, and so there probably isn't this opportunity for poor people. But, yeah, I think, and I don't think the problem is inequality. I think it's poverty and not enough opportunity.
How do you change his mind? Because he has so much influence.
Well, I haven't gotten an invitation. I don't know. There are many more articulate people than I who probably are talking to him, but it'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be.
Yeah, okay. I will accept if I get an invitation to send a book or something. Okay.
I heard Charles Krauthammer comment on the Pope in his statement, and he said... that probably he didn't have a good understanding of economics, but
correct,
that wasn't his job.
Well, okay, the Pope doesn't have good understanding of economics, I agree. That isn't his job, I moderately agree. But if he doesn't have a good understanding of it, he shouldn't talk about it. So much as I think he is a good man in many ways and humble and probably as from indications, a personal trust in Christ, in spite of the things in the Catholic system that we would disagree with and would hinder that. But bad economic policy. Let me say something more about the inequality problem. As nations develop, if even if an economy is growing 10% a year, which is just almost unheard of over time, what happens is 10% and 10% and 10% and 10% and 10% and 10%. The poor are getting richer, but the rich get richer faster. Because if you're making $50,000, you add 10%, you add $5,000 to your salary. If you're making $500,000 and you get 10% more, that's $50,000 to your salary as opposed to $5,000. So forever throughout history, inequality is going to increase when societies grow economically. Mathematically, it's necessary that that will happen. The question is not, are people getting richer at the top and farther away from the poor? The question is, are the poor advancing so that they can get to a higher area, a higher amount of income? And are all the people in society advancing? Do they have opportunity to advance? That's the problem. The other way of looking at that is saying, there are so many sick people in society. You know what the problem is? There are too many healthy people. We shouldn't have all these healthy people. They're booking the inequalities and their health inequality. They're driving it way up. No, the healthy people aren't the problem. It's that the unhealthy people are sick, and we need to solve the sickness. We don't need to hinder the healthy people. Something like that. Eric Finley from ADF.
Something I heard from an African missionary once may be helpful with regard to the whole traffic laws and situation we were just talking about, and that is that he had been in South Africa, which is not as bad as some nations, but still has a large problem with bribery of police officers. Yep. And he told the story once of being pulled over by a police officer, and they expect bribes to be let out of traffic infractions and so forth. And sometimes they'll even pull you over when you didn't commit one so they can get a bribe.
Yep.
So the bribery problem, which goes to the points in your book, too, about the importance of moral values in a society, helping it. On a number of levels. Obviously, the bribery problem there is affecting whether or not people feel like there's value in obeying traffic
Absolutely.
Laws. Yep. Because they can always bribe a police officer to
Absolutely.
Get out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. We're going to get into that a little bit more next week when we talk about the government of the system, or the week after. Yeah, Rick has a microphone back here. Duff?
Hi, Wayne. In the news media, generally, they refer to free markets and capitalism kind of in the same context.
Yep.
And I don't know if you covered this before or Barry did, but could you give us your impression of what the difference is?
Well, there are a lot of different meanings. Thanks, Duff, for that good question. There are a lot of different meanings that people have in their minds about capitalism. Some people in colleges or in European universities have been brought up to think capitalism means cheating and greed and selfishness and people who put money before everything and don't care for others, and they've got all sorts of distortions of it. Or people think of capitalism, they think of Latin America with a few number of people holding all the wealth in their hands and nobody else can get ahead, and it's what's called crony capitalism, and it's really evil, and because it traps people in poverty. And so they've got all these distortions. So we decided, after running into so many people, especially in Eastern Europe, that had a wrong idea of capitalism, we thought, why try to use a word that has so many wrong ideas in some people's mind? In the good sense of capitalism, we agree with it. And it's a free market society. But we thought free market did better at describing it. I just sent in an essay last week to a book of essays on defending capitalism, so you can't get rid of a term immediately, but we're working on it. Last question. Anybody else or comment? Okay, way over here. Brian.
I don't know how this fits into your economic outlook, but when I was younger, I prayed for a bicycle. And after a while...
You what?
Prayed for a bicycle.
Yes, okay.
And after a while, I realized I wasn't going to get it, so I stole one.
Oh.
And then I ask God to forgive me.
Yep.
So it's a joke.
Okay. Did you ever get a job and work for a bicycle?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's the approved. I thought what was he going to say, and I thought that would be the approved solution. Okay. I'm 4 minutes over, and I really owe it to the church to get out on time, so I'd better not do any more. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your great wisdom and for this richness that is from your word and the moral values it teaches. And Lord, but we do bring our hearts back to you now, and we focus on you, and we tell you that we long for you to be first in our hearts. And in spite of all our talk about material productivity, and in addition to all our thankfulness for the very prosperous society in which you've placed us, and the opportunities you've given us, and this church, we thank you for all of these things, but above all these things, Lord, we thank you for yourself, for your cross, for dying for our sins, and we ask that this truth about the world being crucified to us and us to the world, so that we no longer are trapped by a love for it, that would be increasingly true this week in our lives as well. And open our eyes, Lord, through this week to see, to recognize as we are shopping in stores or we're driving down the road, to see the moral advantages of a free market system such as we have left of it here in the United States, and to be thankful for that, thankful to you as well. Amen. See you next week.